morning and welcome to the United Lodge of Theosophists here in Philadelphia. This lodge is one of many lodges around the world whose purpose it is to promulgate the fundamental principles of the philosophy of theosophy. And why is this important for us individually and for the world at large? Because in these fundamental ideas, we see a basis for a truer realization of the self, of each and all, and a basis for a deeper conviction that universal brotherhood is a fact in nature. And we can see how the realization of such ideas through a philosophy of common sense and justice would immediately have practical relevance in our everyday lives. So, in order to make these ideas available to the public and also for the opportunity for those interested to perform an individual and collective study of these ideas. Here in Philadelphia, we have a few weekly activities and opportunities in that regard. On Sunday mornings, we have a formal presentation of some aspect of the philosophy, usually either in the form of a lecture or a forum or a panel, with plenty of opportunity for questions, answers, and discussion. This Sunday morning meeting begins at 11 and goes to 12 noon. The doors open at 10:30. And then on Wednesday evening, there is the opportunity for a more in-depth study of the philosophy in a book we are using this year called The Ocean of Theosophy by William Q. Judge. And it is an opportunity to grasp the entirety of the philosophy in a synthesized way that is on one hand easy to understand, yet profound in its implications and applications. So, as the name of the book suggests, it is an ocean whose at the shore a child could wade and find benefit, and yet in its deepest aspects it would overwhelm the capacities of the greatest minds. And so there's plenty of opportunity for us to explore and investigate these ideas. So this class begins at 7:30 and lasts till 8:30. The subject we are getting into, the chapter we are moving into now, is called Psychic Forces and Phenomena. And this Wednesday we will specifically look at laws of cohesion and polarity, yes, thank you. Cohesion and polarity, which, as we'll see, not only relate to nature, but also to the human being as well. Before the meeting, there are library hours, and those library hours go from 5:15 to 7:15 on Wednesday. There is a student there serving as a volunteer librarian who can help you find the part and the reference for that evening, but also any aspect of the philosophy you might be interested in independently studying. There's also an accompaniment of other books in art, science, philosophy, religion, because we see that theosophy is a universal tutor. It helps us connect the dots between all these human disciplines and also to see the one underlying truth that is in all these ideas. So there's that opportunity, but also we have on the book table displayed straight line theosophical literature, books, pamphlets, and magazines, which can be purchased at the cost of publication and shipping. There's no profit made by the lodge in the sales of these books. Yet here is a chance for one to determine their own plan and course of investigation and research into these ideas. There is a volunteer available there who can answer your questions regarding that. And those opportunities are available before and after meetings and during library hours. Now, all these activities require time, service, and effort. And these are supplied voluntarily by those who have associated themselves with the lodge because they see in the teaching something that resonates with what their understanding of life is, and also feel a independent desire to be devoted to the cause of theosophy, which is the cause of the highest service of humanity. So if one is so interested, we do have on the book table associate cards, which one can take home and consider and bring back signed if they wish to affiliate themselves formally as an associate of the United Lodge of Theosophists. And this calls upon no obligation other than what the individual himself or herself determines that they wish to contribute. So, this morning, we are continuing this month in the consideration of theosophy in everyday ethics. As you know, we had two larger meetings on Saturday mornings throughout the past year devoted to these subjects. And so this month, we thought we would pick up each Sunday some aspect of our everyday ethics that we didn't get to. So we will see that this is sort of like a workshop, an opportunity for not only us to study the principles, but to figure out together how we can apply them in the situations of everyday life. And this morning's topic is a thought-provoking one entitled Ancient Wisdom for the Modern Business World. And our method this morning is we will have a forum. There will be a short talk followed by an opportunity for questions, answers, and discussion on this subject. So we will now have that talk presented.
It's easy to put the modern business community down. Hardly a day goes by when there isn't some scandal brought to our attention, some shameful deed of the business community that is brought right in front of us. Recently, in the last couple of years, we had the housing scandal, which set the whole world economy reeling. Some of the world still hasn't gotten over it. Nations and individuals who lost their life savings, who lost their retirement, those things that they were looking forward to, their children's money for college, wiped out by the greed of a few. We had also the private prisons who were paying judges for convictions of children so that they could fill their prisons and make a profit. So as I said, they're very easy to target our scorn towards. But we have to remember also at the same time that business serves a purpose. Business serves our physical needs, our needs for food, clothing, and shelter. And it does, here in the West, we can say it does a relatively good job. Food, you can hardly travel a block without running into at least 2 or 3 restaurants. And it's the same on the highway. It can bring food out of season. You can have watermelon with your Thanksgiving dinner if you so desire. It has done a great job for that. The same thing with clothing. You have no problem. Even those who have no income can find clothing because there's so much of it that the Goodwill stores and the churches are filled with donations. So yes, it's done a good job with that. Even housing, we have a homeless population, but even among our homeless population, they can find shelter for an evening, a place to wash up, and even a meal. So although it's not as we desire, it has been they have done a very good job in that, looking at it from that narrow point of view. But if you step back and you look at it from a broader point of view and check out the ideology of modern business, you begin to see a problem arise. We see that they're driven solely by self-interest. Now, at their best, businesses act in accordance with the law. They minimize the social costs of their operations while working to maximize their profits to satisfy their investors. But at their worst, they become single-minded entities seeking only monetary short-term gain without regard for the consequences to their workers, society in general, and nature. Now, given these two ends of business, we ask, can ancient wisdom inform the business community of the possibility of living by altruistic principles when they are expected to pursue a largely selfish agenda in life, sacrificing all for the sacred bottom line? Can the ancient wisdom of theosophy rescue us from our modern business predicament? Does it have the power to nullify the corrosive effects of greed for money? Most theosophical groups are usually pinched for funds, offering no temptation for those who are susceptible to the siren call of money, attracting instead those who harbor more of a desire for the spiritual side of life. Such a situation as this makes it seem that ancient wisdom can play no effective part in the current business dilemma. After all, the pursuit, reward, and aim of business is money. At one time in the history of the Theosophical movement, it was thought by some that a financial treasury was a necessary prerequisite for the advancement and growth of the movement. This was a natural idea to the Western minds of that time. Most achievements of Western societies were, and are still, the end result of monetary investments. Remember, the Pilgrims were funded by an investment group, as was Christopher Columbus. instead of money to fight with and for, Theosophy had an inspiring ideal. And instead of a corporate funds to work with, we have had devotion, which causes the members to use their own private means and imaginations in the promoting of theosophical ideas and ideals. The adherents may be rich or poor, but their sincerity and dedication are more than suitable for the task at hand, which is the uplifting of humanity. Furthermore, as corroboration, if you have time, study the lives of Thomas Paine, Socrates, and the Buddha. And then ask yourself, what part did money play in their greatness and their contribution to humanity? Thomas Paine died in what we might term poverty. Socrates was proud of his impoverished condition, and the Buddha turned his back on wealth and privilege, teaching these lines instead. The impulse I want and the impulse I'll have, lose them. That is where most people get stuck. Without those, you can use your eyes to guide you through this suffering state. The ancient wisdom, that is Theosophy, teaches us who we are and what we are and the laws that govern our existence. A true understanding of these laws, which include reincarnation, karma, and brotherhood, obliges one to see beyond monetary profits. Ideas such as duty, service, and sharing enter into the thoughts and consciousness and the heart, your heart, making you realize that you are a facet of the whole, not a thing separate and alone, and that you cannot escape the consequences of your actions, be they positive or negative. Short-term gains that require you to misuse others isn't short-term. The consequences of such transactions will be answered, and time and location offer no barriers from those consequences. Every prophet, avatar, and messenger has given the same message: do unto others as you would have them do unto you, reminding us of our interdependency. We are also offered from the same sources: do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth, where moths and vermin destroy, and where thieves break in and steal, but store up for yourselves treasures in heaven. This was offered to remind us of what is eternal and what is temporary. The ability to discriminate between the two helps to decrease our thirst for the transient treasure of our senses. Perhaps the reason that we have such a problem with modern business is that there is a fundamental discord at the core of the business philosophy being taught and practiced today. Its ideals are competition and ambition. These two qualities are needed in a market economy. This philosophy equates good with the accumulation of money, money to build or seize power, impose your will upon others, wage war, and divide the strong from the weak. Everything in these ideas is in direct opposition to what the Christ of the New Testament, the Buddha, or any other enlightened friend of humanity has taught. This philosophy has turned the world upside down. Corporations, stock markets, currencies, consumer indexes, quarterly economic projections are ideas which came into being to serve humanity, not humanity serve them. That makes idols of these ideas, making business institutions the equal of man. How can that be? When humanity can and has existed without any of these institutions, but they have no existence without humanity. The message from the ancient wisdom to modern business is simple. Bring the philosophy of modern business into accord with universal law. That is where true success lies. Turn your ambition to compete into serving humanity and preserving nature. That will be a worthy bottom line.
In the ancient sacred books of India, there is given a description of four castes or natural divisions of human beings, and we read about these in the Bhagavad Gita. And one of those castes is the merchant class, or what they would call in Sanskrit the Vaishya class. And as an allegory, each of these castes is said to come from one of the aspects of Brahma, the priestly caste from the head, the warrior caste from the arms, the merchant class from the thighs, and of course the servant class from the feet. Obviously, all are necessary. You need to work together for there to be a productive human being. But the symbolism of the thighs representing the merchant class gives us an idea of its importance, because the thighs, as we know, are the largest and strongest muscles in the body for a very good reason. They have to support the weight of the whole, and they have to be strong and mobile and flexible in order to therefore be movement and interaction between individuals and groups of individuals. So in the sacred books, there were extensive ethics and guidelines on spiritual principles, based on spiritual principles, as how to each one of these castes was supposed to conduct themselves. And so the Vaishya, the merchant class, was charged with the important task of providing for the material benefit and welfare of the community through the trade and interchange of goods and services. And as a result, the prosperity could be distributed among the people in the providing of food, housing, shelter, temples, all of which were needed. And it is said that originally there were four castes, each one representing a specific group of qualities in the human being, and as these qualities were distributed, some in possession of certain qualities would be better off as priests or warriors or merchants or servants. But it was all based on the natural qualities. But in our time, as we move into the Kali Yuga, which is a period of time that lasts 5,000 years and extends many thousands of years in the future, these qualities are intermixed. And so every human being has the quality of a priest, a warrior, a merchant, a servant, mixed within them in different degrees. So that brings the ethics of the modern business world down to us individually and personally. We know this morning we've heard a very good message about the spiritual principles, the ethics, the theosophy, and all the great saviors and founders of religions, what they have to say about business ethics. And it makes it seem as though it's a problem out there. But we interact with these businesses. We provide them with income and trade. We are the source of their profits, the reason they exist. And as was pointed out, without humanity, individually and collectively, there could be no business. So this morning, then, we are not only going to look at the larger aspect, but also what does the ancient wisdom have to tell us about our interaction with the business world? Where is our responsibility? Where do we fit in the larger picture of what businesses should, how business should react to the society, the community, with nature, and so forth? So we then open it up for your questions and comments in the back.
Well, this is all well and good, but how am I supposed to gather the information to find out if the business I'm dealing with is really ethical? All I have at this point is some information and lots of trust. How do I know that the grocer I deal with isn't dealing badly with the people that supply to him? How am I supposed to do this? Mm-hmm. With all the wisdom that's there for me, how do I handle this?
Yes. It is mentioned that the business world has become remarkably complex, even much more since the books we study were written. But being more complex, they are necessarily under more regulation and law. They are guided by laws of the land, as well as business ethics. And it is part of the training and culture of businesses to not only instruct and have guidelines in the conduct of their business and awareness of the law, but also in business ethics. And it is a matter of researching to, if you're dealing with a specific company or business, to see what their ethical and business guidelines are, if there's been any infractions of those, if there's any violations of those. But also, they make information available about the extent to which they put services back into the community. For example, there is a product which we're not going to mention it by name, but it's a bar, a fruit and nut bar, which has a very nice name. And the reason they chose that name was not only because the ingredients there are natural and good for you, but because the profits acquired from that go back to the community in providing us services. And they make available publicly all the different activities that they put their profits towards. So yes, it becomes the individual responsibility of each of us, if we want to have an impact to the extent we can, to check these things out, to research. And that's okay, because that's why we're here. We don't want to be just dependent on what other people say, on outside sources of authority. We want to know the truth of these ideas for ourselves, and we're willing to make the time and effort to individually investigate. And so that same kind of questioning, discrimination, discernment that we show here, that we bring to our studies, has to be also, or should be, we should say, applied to the larger world. Yes.
Sometimes it's easier because of the personality or the way the person in charge handles his or her staff, the language used, lot of money, but knowing this is not a proper person to be doing business with.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to, at some point, if we have the information, or if we see it playing out right in front of us, if this is the way the boss is treating us, we can be sure
yes.
he's acting that way in other areas of the business. We have to be willing to decide if we want to stay and make that money, or we want to distance ourselves from us.
So the point here is that the business world is an opportunity for many of us in the work we do in providing goods and services to meet our family's needs and our own needs, to come in contact and relate, and to have a laboratory in which we can put these noble ethics and ideas of the unity of life, reincarnation, karma, the spiritual evolution, the perfectibility of man into practice, to test, check, and verify to see if they're true, if they make sense, if they are practical. And so one of the ways and we come in contact is in the business world, and the contribution made is certainly a common experience. We think also one that's very common and we will have to face sooner or later in our dealings with employers is when we are asked to do things or witness things done which we know are ethically improper, illegal, hurtful. What are we to do? What is our responsibility? Do we stay, keep quiet? Do we leave and keep quiet? Do we blow the whistle, so to speak? And it becomes a very important moral decision that we have to face. In the back. Well, the idea of bartering and social sharing of services on the surface seems to be a more equal opportunity. However, it can be abused, and we know this. We've seen failures and abuses of the social system. But more importantly, we might say the market system we have, the means of business we have, is not inherently evil. It is an opportunity for individual effort, self-induced, advised effort, rewards based on individual efforts put forth, incentives to be of good service to others, to learn to communicate effectively with others, to make others feel comfortable, not just for themselves, but for obviously for benefit that comes from them. So it's an opportunity for give and take based on individual effort. There's incentive built into it. So in that case, it would promote productivity. So the problem is really more the abuse of the system. And here's where the problem really gets down to the individual human nature. It's how we act, the qualities we bring forth when we are dealing in business with others. Are we in a business situation? And we remember from the platform a student bringing up from the exam a very simple matter. You go to the store, you buy a product, the teller rings up the bill and accidentally gives you back more money than you needed. Now that becomes a business problem because there was exchange of goods and services. So what do you do? Well, for many, it would depend whether they were shortchanged, what they would say, or if they were overpaid, what they would say. But from a theosophical perspective, when we bring in the ideas of reincarnation, responsibility, what might happen to the other person, how do we react? What do we do? So we see that the business, whole idea of the business world gets down to how do we individually act in the business situation, how do we act in a family situation, how do we act in a school situation. In each way, we bring forth some of those different qualities of the cast forward. How do we act in a conflict situation as the warrior? How do we act in a learning situation as the priest? How do we act in the situation where we have to be the foundation, the basis of a community, the servant of our family, bringing in the qualities of the servant class, or the that idea? Yes. Oh.
So far we're dealing with the individual and his obligations, which is a good place to start. But what of the institutions that we have authorized to protect us on our behalf? In that scandal about the housing, the Department of Justice had never brought a case against any individual. The FDA has not done anything about the genetically modified foods. It's still in front of us. And these are foods that are genetically modified, never been tested. We don't know what the end results will be on us and our children in the years to come from eating this.
Yes.
So it seems as though a lot of the really disastrous effects are out of our hands to control at this time, unless the OSCE can show us something that we can do.
Mm-hmm. Well, the example was brought up of Socrates, Buddha, Jesus,
Thomas Paine.
These were individuals who dealt with institutional reforms. And of course, there was pushback from it. They were there to reform, and there was consequences of that. But it does bring upon us the idea that institutions are changing. It is said that we're living in a time in this aspect of the Kali Yuga where all institutions are changing, political, social, financial. It is even reflected in the conduct of and the governments of nations, even in the weather and the climates and geological activity of the earth, where it is a rapid changing time, a transition age. So in a transition age where everything is changing, there is the opportunity for the individual to act and bring about more change in the institutions or changes than they could in a slower moving age. But like anything else, we can either say, well, I want to be of true service of humanity, but humanity's in such a mess, it seems, where do I begin? It's an impossible task. And so the message of the ancient wisdom is, well, you have to begin with yourself. You have to make a study of yourself, see your strengths and weaknesses, check, test, and verify how you can change yourself in the light of ideas. But then you take it the next step. If you want to begin to change some aspect of the institutions you deal with, you can't deal with it, and you can't have power over it unless you become an informed, educated citizen. And we all have that opportunity. And if there's any benefit to the internet, it's improved our opportunity to become more informed and interact and have greater social impact on institutions than we had 25, 30 years ago. Yes?
Pharmaceutical companies have made billions of dollars manufacturing drugs that really haven't healed epilepsy, diabetes, cancers, but they're making billions of dollars despite the fact. Now, these are valid attempts for modern man's futile attempts to come up with healing techniques, but they certainly fall far short of modern disease. question is, how does theosophy view the use of these ineffective medicines on the human body versus the spiritual techniques used by the yogis in India, for example, that are highly effective?
Well, it's interesting. The question brings up so many aspects that we could spend a few classes just on that question. But in the idea of healing the body, the ancient wisdom and theosophy we have is a portion of that accumulated ancient wisdom tells us that the power of the spiritual aspect of the human being is such that it can change the body, but it shouldn't be used. We should not bring down the spiritual powers of the human being to necessarily remove physical illness, because it doesn't really remove it. It throws it back on the mental plane and it rebounds and comes out later. So this covers a variety of so-called spiritual practices, which are really psychic practices. They seem to be effective in the short term, but in the longer term, they delay and even aggravate the symptoms, just as certain kinds of treatments can. So theosophy would say, use physical means to cure physical illnesses. And for whatever, as the pointed out in the presentation initially, for everything we can say negatively about an industry, that healthcare industry, we can also say and point to the remarkable things that are possible that weren't possible even 10, 15 years ago. Are they sometimes misregulated? Are they sometimes misused? Of course, that's why there's federal agencies and laws that govern them or try to. But the message is that you, once again, need to be your own advocate, your own research. You have to investigate, check, test everything you use. Become independent. Just don't rely on external authorities. There was a time when the word of the doctor was unchallenged, and whatever the doctor said was right. Well, that's not necessarily necessary. That's not necessary right now, because individuals can get their own information. They can check, test it, and verify it with medical experts, but they are not completely helpless either to what the drug companies say or what the doctors say. Yes?
The previous generations, those that were affected by World War II, Depression, their ideas were formulated from that physical experience. And they had children who they wanted to have more than they did. So what we had after the war was all these little communities popping up everywhere. And the fact that we have such a
Well, can we pick up your idea there and see where, if it's where you want to go with it? The idea, there used to be the idea, the economic idea of a generation, that prosperity and extended to the family was trying to keep up with a certain standard and to provide and to make it possible for your descendants to have an even better life materially. And we might also say, and some says, that the logical carrying forth of that idea to keep providing more and more things in a material way to people could very well have been responsible for getting us into the trouble we have now, where it is possibly true that our descendants will have less of a good material life than we do. So, in every setback, And this is not just in the economic life, it's in all aspects of our life. Setbacks are part of life, but in every setback, there's an opportunity to question, how did I get here? Maybe there is an opportunity that I didn't recognize. And maybe there's more to ensuring the prosperity of future generations than just teaching them that the more things they have, the better off they'll be. Maybe we need to teach them to be more mannerly, more virtuous, more aware, more involved, more considerate. Turn off the cell phones at the dinner table and the TV and sit down and talk to one another, to have that opportunity. And we might even say many of the families and communities before the time you were talking about had just that. They didn't have a lot of things, a lot of money, but they had the opportunity some hungry nights to just sit down and read and talk and feed their minds and souls and not just their bodies. So, yes, in the back.
But they're the very people who hoped for, pushed for, and managed to get something
yes.
more, like cell phones.
Yes.
So our problem always seems to be we don't appreciate the little that we have and have all these dreams for acquiring more.
Yes, we see that pendulum effect, do we not? We seem to swing back and forth and into extremes rather than doing what the Buddha suggests, to take the middle road. And, you know, he gives an eightfold path, and one of the aspects of that eightfold path is proper occupation, right occupation. And here's another aspect of spiritual wisdom. If it is your job to serve in the military, you get paid for that. Or it is your job to be in the manufacturing of meat and meat products. There's nothing wrong with that ethically. If it is your heart and your love of your community and your family, and that is your way you make business or earn a living, to serve the welfare of the nation with the right motive, with the right ideal in the armed forces, fine. Or to provide meat. It is not necessarily more ethical to be in a vegetarian or a natural food industry. It all depends on what the motive and the condition of the society one lives in. But one thing we are warned against is not to engage in the business of profit in the providing of spiritual information, spiritual knowledge. And we can see that one of the evils of the modern business world is ideas that used to be sacred and taught under oath and secrecy are put before the public as they were the next snake oil, with promises of health, of great benefit, influence, for a fee. And whether that be in the development of serious meditative skills, or psychic powers, or occult powers, or the attainment quickly of the wisdom of the ages, or even the release from future lives of bad karma for a fee. All that is discouraged, because whenever the spiritual is brought down and put on the marketplace, the natural vulnerability of our personality and our self-interest takes that spiritual and degrades it and uses it in a harmful way. The spiritual powers abused are much more deadly and horrific than the material powers abused. Material force is limited in its reach. spiritual psychic powers when misused, when directed selfishly for profit or benefit over others, have a much more pervasive, hidden, and extended influence, not only in nature, but in the but in ourselves and in those we love the most. So that is a very important aspect of the application of ancient wisdom. Yes.
With respect to, you know, the cycle going through the depression and everything, we were speaking to an elderly lady in her 90s who's now deceased when the recent huge challenges in the economy were happening in 2008 and all that. And in her view, and her, with her experiences, it was her opinion that that would be fine because our generation needs to go through another depression for all the right reasons with morality and appreciating what you have. But also, we think one of the problems, kind of theosophically speaking, we feel kind of bad for the deception that leaders of industry put themselves through, and the population allows that to happen. One of the biggest problems in this century is that leaders of big profitable corporations are encouraged to use their creative powers of desire, but are protected by law from the from experiencing the effects when all that goes south, because it's on the corporation, it's not me. I'm not responsible for it. And one of the examples of that that plays right into the 2008 is when you have companies like Smith Barney and Shearson Lehman, when they were originated, the people were partners. And if a partner made a stupid decision, then that could financially wipe out all the partners. So you really made your decisions based on wise, based on wisdom of business.
Mm-hmm.
Today, any high-level executive in a stock company or in a stock market can make the dumbest decisions that can wipe out millions of people and go home, and the worst thing that's going to happen to him is he's going to get fired.
Mm-hmm.
Because he's not being held responsible.
Right.
And then we would just like to say the last thing is the accumulation of wealth is not per se evil. You know, Timothy, 2 Timothy says it's not the love of money that's the root of all evil. No, it's not the money that's the root of all evil. It's the love of money that's the root of all evil.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're wealthy, the question is, what are you doing with it?
Yes. Yeah. Well, it certainly seems insurmountable as you express it. But let's go back a few hundred years here in Philadelphia. And there's this guy on the corner of 2nd and Market. His name is Payne. And he really is. Because he's saying things that can really get us in trouble. Telling us to get rid of slaves, to declare ourselves, not to deal with England, but declare ourselves free and independent from England. England, the strongest military power on earth, whose armies and navies ruled the world. And we're in a community where the majority of us are Quakers running businesses and don't want to be fighters. And the others are very much involved with the largest seaport in the world in Philadelphia, doing business all over the world. And the entire economic flows through Philadelphia. And we have this guy running around and tell us that we each have to take independent responsibility for the rights of man. And yet, because a relatively few people were inspired and willing to do that through his words, we're not talking about Franklin and Jefferson and Washington and Adams, who said, wow, this guy is really saying something. We're talking about the masses who, many of them couldn't read, But those that could went out and bought his book, Common Sense, and read it to others. And Franklin published some of his works because it lit up a whole generation to do something that seemed impossible. I talk about overcoming multi-conglomerates. He was talking about going up against the strongest economic and military power in the world at that time. And we did it. So who's to say what can or cannot be done if enough individuals get inspired by a few ideals? And as it says in the Declaration, are willing to put their lives, their fortunes, and their sacred honor behind it. Yes, in the past.
Well, Thomas Paine himself, though, didn't say, I wrote this.
Yes.
He said, when I get these ideas, they come full blown. They're already complete when I receive them.
Yes.
So he pointed to ancient wisdom
yes.
as the source
yes.
of his own writing.
He said the ideas bolted into his mind out of the blue, already full form. But those ideas, wherever they may have come from, and there are statements in the philosophy as to what their origin is, they could have fell as easily on deaf ears, on lazy ears, on uninvolved ears, but they fell on the ears and on the mind and heart of an individual who was already willing and to act on them. And so we give that individual credit where it's due. And we have these same ideas put before us. We're not asked to take on the conglomerates, but we are asked to take on our own conglomerate, to begin to take control of those institutions in our own nature which seem to have the control right now, and say, well, maybe I can be a little bit more compassionate, gentle, considerate, and build up my abilities that way. But working together, there are, like we said, there are many more opportunities for individuals and group of individuals to exert effort, to change laws. And as a result of the debacle in 2008, we think there's been a wake-up call, if not completely to governments, at least to individuals, that they have to do that. They have to protect themselves. Yes.
You mentioned the soldier. So if an 18 or 19-year-old person goes into the military, enlists for a vocation, a job, without any, you know, high ambitions, eventually as he progresses through his development and becomes a full-blown official soldier, and eventually is placed into battle and ends up killing an enemy, because this was his vocation, is he karmically bound for that death, or is he expiated because this is his job?
Mm. Well,
what does the law say on that?
Well, if we go back to the Bhagavad Gita, it tells us the idea of the glorious unsought fight. That all fortunes favored soldiers can obtain. So yes, it depends on the motive. Not all young people go into the military just looking for a job opportunity or an educational opportunity, although it exists there. Some go because all their relatives did, or maybe because one of their relatives was killed, or maybe some friends they know were killed. Or maybe they really have that love of patriotism. Next week we're talking about personal, impersonal love. Well, one of the aspects of love that we feel, just as individuals have more love for another human being or another family member or another friend, some people vary in the love they really and genuinely feel for their nation. And they're willing to do what they can to help. We're not saying everybody, of course not. But the karma of the individual engaged in that service depends on the thought and the feeling that they bring to it, not the outer act. And if we, and we might even say that there's opportunities for discipline and interdependence and working as a team and unity that exist in that kind of situation that don't. And so just as the warrior capacities exist in us all, there are some situations like the military that bring to the fore all those latent abilities that we all have. And there are some institutions like college that bring through all our priestly abilities. Or some institutions like voluntary organizations that bring forth all our servant. Or certain institutions like that bring through all our business qualities. Each situation brings forth something in our nature to be developed. How we develop it, how we use to it, is the key. So next week, as we said, we'll take up this subject of personal and impersonal love, and then this Wednesday, of course, getting into the idea of psychic forces and phenomena. Our meeting's adjourned.